Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on 1 Second After when we come back. You know, the genealogical or the genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. And now our national leaders have subscribed to a plan created by the Club of Rome, the United Nations, and the Trilateral Commission, amidst a whole host and plethora of other lesser policy-making think tanks, to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years. Now, that's not an error. That's 90% over the next 50 years. So let's not delude ourselves into believing that you and I are going to stop all of these mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians in their insane scheme to enslave the world and impose this new world order or this worldwide tyranny upon all of us. But you and I don't have to participate in our own demise. We don't have to help them. We don't have to finance them or stand helplessly by and do nothing either. That's why I contend it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy scientists and these philosophers and preachers and politicians, and let you and I prepare to live through and survive this Global 2000, this New World Order nightmare. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. Doesn't cost you anything. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational. It's informative. It's entertaining. And best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you want to get a copy of that off of our internet site, go to our webpage, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page and you can download that free General Law CD package right there. Hey, I just finished reading a book here. It's called 1 Second After. It's written by a fellow named William R. Forshen. An odd spelling name here. It's an odd name. Here's the way to spell it. It's F-O-R-S-T. C-H-E-N, William R. Forshen, with a foreword by Newt Gingrich. It's called 1 Second After. In the past, we have, in our subsistence and survival school, identified 64 life-threatening problems that come out of the Bible, come out of Scripture. And now I have added number 65. Number 65. It also comes out of the Bible, but it's a takeoff on a problem, nuclear war, that we see in Ezekiel chapter 5 and Ezekiel 6 verse 6. Nuclear bomb war is coming to America, like it or lump it. What we don't know is when is it going to come and how bad is it going to be. When I was a youngster back in the 1950s, it was said that here in America there were 400 targets, only 12 major targets in Russia. 400 targets here in the United States. And so we thought back in the 50s and 60s that if the Russians launched an attack against us, that they would launch 400 nuclear weapons against 400 cities and military targets. And as a result of that, it was going to create a tremendous amount of fallout. And fallout maps were made up. And you could take a look at your location in the United States and see how bad the fallout was, you know, probably going to be or would most likely be based upon prevailing wind patterns and so on. And so that's what we prepared for. But by the 1970s, a new philosophy came up. It was called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. And according to that theory, as soon as the Russians launched an attack against the United States, we would launch a preemptive, well, not preemptive, but we would launch a responsive attack to their preemptive attack, because we'd always said, well, we would never launch a first strike. So we've always been expecting the Russians to launch that first strike. And then it was brought to our attention that because of rockets, you wouldn't have very much warning. In other words, if you're living in downtown Los Angeles, you know, and a nuclear attack is on its way, from the time the missile is launched somewhere in Siberia and flies up over the North Pole and lands in Los Angeles, you'd have about 30 minutes warning. And what we were expecting is that our satellites would give us an early warning, in that as soon as they launched their rocket, we would know it. And we'd be able to track the trajectory of it and figure out about where it was going to land. Albeit you'd only have 30 minutes warning, and probably you wouldn't have your radio on, and maybe by the time you got a warning, you know, you might be 5 or 10 minutes away from impact. And so the theory was, you can't evacuate these cities. I mean, trying to get people out of Los Angeles was just beyond anything that could be physically done. So the MAD theory came in. Well, if you people are crazy enough to do that, you need to understand that we're going to make sure that we launch our rockets, and that we've got 30 minutes, and by God, we're going to get you. Well, then in the 1990s, we adopted a new policy. It was a new policy that we're not going to launch a preemptive strike against the Russians, but that we're not going to launch a reactive strike against the Russians either. And we're going to wait and see what kind of a strike we're going to make after the fact. And I thought, well, now that doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense, but, you know, I'm not a strategic planner. But then I came to a new piece of information. I don't know if I've brought this up yet, but the Russians are not going to launch their preemptive attack against us with rockets that we'll be able to track with our satellites and give us 30 minutes warning. You see, they've already launched all of the missiles that they're going to drop on us. They're already up in orbit. That's right. The Russians have put 64, the number that I saw here, 64 satellites are up there, or maybe it's fewer satellites with two or three bombs in each one. I can't tell you how many satellites are up there, but the number I got was 64. They've already launched them, already put them up in orbit, and they're circling around the world now, and all they have to do is push the button and it drops out of orbit and hits your city. Isn't that special? Now, I don't know if the Chinese have done anything like that. Now, the Chinese don't have the size nuclear arsenal that the Russians have by any stretch of the imagination, but the Pakistanis have around 60 nukes, and it's estimated that the Israelis have about 60. The Chinese, they think, have about 200. The Russians have several thousand, and we Americans have several thousand. The British and the French, I haven't seen any numbers on. There are 9 members now of the nuclear club, leaving North Korea out because we don't know what kind of a weapon they've got. It isn't very good, and it's not very big, at least not yet. And then, of course, the Iranians want to join the club. And we're getting to a point now where Bible prophecy is just about to be fulfilled. At some point in time, somebody's going to drop a nuke, either by accident or by design. In fact, the Russians had 38 what they called suitcase nukes. These are very small, tiny nuclear weapons that would fit in a suitcase. 38 of them went missing after the collapse of the Soviet Union about 1990, 91, 92, somewhere along in there. And I figured that if there's anybody that's got one or two of those, it would be Osama bin Laden, don't you think? Guy's got plenty of money. And I'm sure, you know, that if he put the word out on the street, hey, look, I'd like to buy one of those. Now, I think if he had one of those, he'd probably use it. And if he didn't use it, well, then, you know, if there's somebody else out there that could get hold of one, they would. We live in a pretty dangerous world. In fact, Pakistan is so politically unstable. The big fear now is that Pakistan will fall into the hands of the Taliban. You know, the radicals. And with it, their nuclear arsenal will fall into the hands of the Taliban. Now, that doesn't sound like a very good plan, does it? And then we have Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. See, for those of us, the white Anglo-Saxons here in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and in Western Europe, we have a God that we've breached his contract, and he's kind of up in arms. He's been telling us now for the last couple thousand years that he's been bummed out. We haven't listened much. And as a result of that, we have a thing called the Great Tribulation, mentioned 30 times in Bible prophecy, that started way back in Moses' time. But all of the minor prophets and the major prophets have been writing about that. You know, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, the major prophets. Daniel wrote a 12-chapter book describing the entire panoply of the Gentiles and the Israelites in an end-time showdown. In fact, in Daniel chapter 12, he made an observation. He said, "The wise would understand, but the wicked would do wickedly, and they wouldn't understand." And what they're not understanding is international geopolitics. This is an international geopolitical game being played. And the Bible places a lot of emphasis on this geopolitical game. In fact, that's what the book is all about. That's what the story is all about. I call it the game. Well, now, two authors have written books. One in 1959. You might want to write these down because I'm going to review both of them at the same time. The first one was written by a guy named Pat Frank in 1959. It's called Alas, Babylon. You wouldn't think that it was a book about geopolitical war and thermonuclear war, but it is. It's been reprinted in 1993. I don't know if you'll find it at Barnes & Noble or not, but it's a... Let's see how many pages are in here. It's 287, about 300 pages, a little over 300 pages. It's a pretty good read. It's a fiction book. It's fiction only from the perspective of the bomb hasn't been dropped yet. And so it's dealing with, back in 1959, 60, along in there, you know, the late 50s, the probable or potential results that would come from a nuclear attack against the United States. The second book over here deals with nuclear war, but a different kind of nuclear war. It's called EMP, Electromagnetic Pulse, EMP. And it's a story that's well worth reading. I heard my first word about EMP back in the 1960s when they talked about a nuclear weapon called the neutron bomb. It was a bomb they were going to set off up in the air and send out pulses from it that would kill all the people, but it wouldn't destroy the buildings. And this EMP is a takeoff on that. It's called the Electromagnetic Pulse. And what it does, well, let me tell you how it first got started. They were testing some bombs down in the South Pacific, you know, back in the early 1960s. And they noticed that in Hawaii, there were electrical components that were knocked out. You know, in the telephone office, it'd knock out the telephones and burn up the wires and one thing and another. And they got to looking at that, and they said, well, gosh, what was going on? And it was an electrical pulse that set off from an atmospheric nuclear test. And the way this EMP works is you set a bomb off about 200 miles in the air, and it sets off an electrical pulse of about 50 volts. 50 volts isn't a whole bunch, but it's enough to fry all of the electronic equipment. The electronic equipment, you know, like your cell phone, your computers, all of the electrical equipment, you know, in your automobile, such as the computer in your car, the electronic ignition. And So they started hardening military installations in the telephone companies. And then they call these Faraday cages. And then they build a thing there called a Faraday cage, and you put your electronic equipment inside this cage, or you build the cage around your building so that it will protect it from this 50-volt surge of electricity so it doesn't knock out the equipment. And so the telephone companies hardened their exchanges. You know, this is back in the 60s and 70s. And then something happened. Starting about the 1980s, the telephone companies quit doing that, and the military isn't doing it either. At least they're not telling us, if they are. But all of the rest of us out here are totally vulnerable. We don't have any protection at all against an EMP. Now, if one EMP was set off over, say, Kansas, it would have enough effect that it would knock out all of the electrical equipment in North America. Probably half of Mexico also, but at least all over North America. Now, to make sure that you knock it all out, you'd set off one of them, say, around Memphis, Tennessee, one of them, say, around Denver, and maybe the third one over around Los Angeles or something like that. In other words, you drop three of them, and you don't drop them on the land. We're not going to blow up any buildings or kill anybody on the ground. When these EMP bombs go off, and they're just regular, ordinary, everyday garden variety 20 megaton nuclear weapons. And if they dropped it on Los Angeles, it would dig a hole 600 feet deep, a half a mile across. But they're not going to drop it on Los Angeles. They're going to set it off up in the atmosphere somewhere so that the electrical pulse will knock out all of the electronics. And the story here that Forshin tells is based upon the probable results that would occur after the EMP is set off. And that got me to thinking. I said, oh my God, you know, we have not prepared for this. For years, you know, students come here to class and we talk about subsistence and survival, where most people are talking about things like camouflage suits and AK-47s and Uzi submachine guns. We kind of downgrade that, and we concentrate here more on the nuts and bolts of life, you know, like food, clothing, and shelter. And nuclear war certainly fits in, and nuclear attack or nuclear war is certainly survivable. And the Russians and Chinese both intend to survive it. And they intend to survive it with the major portion of their populations intact. Only the United States and the Western European countries are prepared for total Armageddon. When this happens, it's all over, and that'll be the end of the story. The Russians and Chinese don't believe it'll be the end of the story. They believe it will be the beginning of a new story, of total Russian and Chinese domination over planet Earth. At least that's their view of it. So there's a biblical view, then there's the Russian and Chinese view, and then there is the Western view. And all of these people have a different view of the way they see the world over the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years. Now, the New World Order people, and they're everywhere now, you know, they have a view. They want to reduce the Earth's population by 90%. That's why we have the Georgia Guidestones and the Club of Rome and the Trilateral Commission, and we have the New World Order guys, and we have this economic collapse coming down on us. These people have an agenda, they have a plan, and they're executing the plan. They're on target, and they're on their agenda, and they've got a plan. Now, there's another guy that has a plan, and not very many people are taking this guy into account. His name is the creator of the universe. They call him Elohim in the Bible. He's the guy that most people refer to as JC, Jesus Christ. Or Yahweh, a lot of people do. Allah, Muslims call him Allah. Everybody has a name for this guy, but he's the creator of the universe. He's got an agenda. He's got a plan, too. So I thought, why don't we put all of these plans into motion here, and let's take a look at them and see how that's likely to affect your life and my life over the next 25 years. Now, the foreword in Forshin's book is by Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives here in the United States. You know, not necessarily a lightweight political player in the game himself. Speaker Newt Gingrich had this to say about EMPs. He said, though this book is a work of fiction, it is also a work of fact, perhaps a future history that should be thought-provoking and, yes, even terrifying for all of us. I know this from personal study across decades of the very real threat to American security that is posed by this particular weapon that Bill Forshen writes about in One Second After. There has been much attention given since 9/11 to a wide variety of threats to our nation, additional attacks by the hijacking of commercial airlines or airliners, biological and chemical attacks, even the potential of a so-called dirty bomb, or even an actual nuclear detonation in the center of one of our major cities. But very few people have ever talked about, let alone heard about, the terrible, in fact, overwhelming threat of an EMP, which is shorthand for electromagnetic pulse weapon. Now, my friend, Captain Bill Sanders of the U.S. Navy, one of our nation's leading experts on this particular weapon, will provide the afterword for this book, explaining in greater detail, using unclassified documents, as to how such a weapon works. In short form here, when an atomic bomb is detonated above the Earth's atmosphere, it can generate a pulse wave which travels at the speed of light and will short-circuit every electronic device that the wave touches on the Earth's surface. It's like a super lightning bolt striking next to your house and taking out your computer, except infinitely worse, because it will strike our entire nation, most likely without any warning, and it could destroy our entire complex electrical grid and everything attached into that grid. It is a very real threat. It is a very big threat, and one that has deeply worried myself and many others for years. Now, my friend Bill Forshen has co-authored 6 historical novels with me across the years, and I've gotten to know him very closely. He holds a Ph.D. in history from Purdue. He has specialized in the history of military technology, and this is no wild flight of fancy on his part. In fact, the start of this book was a conversation that Bill and I shared several years ago, concluding with his announcing that he felt that he should write a novel about the threat to raise public awareness. So as I said before, I see this book as a terrifying future history that might come true. Such books have a significant tradition in their own right. H.G. Wells wrote frighteningly accurate prophecies of what history now calls World Wars I and II. Two of the great classics of the Cold War, Alas, Babylon, and the movie Testament, gave us a profoundly moving glimpse of what would happen to ordinary citizens if war between us and the Soviets was ever unleashed. In fact, Bill will openly admit that those two classics were indeed models for this book. I also compare it to perhaps the most famous of the future history books of modern times, George Orwell's 1984. If the evil of totalitarian regimes had been allowed to flourish in the rubble of Europe after World War II, that future history might have come to pass. Orwell, by his book, raised an awareness that just might have saved us from Big Brother and the thought police. I'd like to think that Bill's novel may do the same. Few in our government and in the public sector have openly confronted the threat offered by the use of but one nuclear weapon in the hands of a determined enemy, who calibrates it to trigger a massive EMP burst. Such an event would destroy our complex, delicate, high-tech society in an instant and throw all of our lives back into an existence equal to that of the Middle Ages. millions would die in the first week alone. Perhaps even if you who are reading this, if you require certain medications, let alone the most basic needs of our lives, such as just food and clean water. The place that Bill writes about is real. He has set this story in his hometown and the college that he works at. I remember when he was writing the book and we'd talk, more than once he was deeply disturbed by what he had researched, what he had discovered, and was now trying to express as a story for everyone to read. What hit him most, he told me, is that he kept picturing his teenage daughter in this nightmare reality. And I think as you read the book, you'll see that point of identification. It struck me deeply as well, because I have two grandchildren. And as he wishes to protect his daughter from this fate, so do I wish to protect my grandchildren, and to be able to pass on to them an America that is safe from such threats. Now, the real threat is, and we as Americans must face that threat, prepare, and know what to do to prevent it. Because if we don't, one second after, the America that we know, cherish, and love will be gone forever. Well, that's the foreword by Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House. He said, you know, this is a very real threat. Now, most of us have probably never even heard this term. I heard about it years ago, but I hadn't thought much about it until I was brought up short. My wife said, here, let me give you this book. And I said, well, what's it about? And she said, well, it's about electromagnetic pulse, nuclear war. And I said, well, I've read a lot of books on nuclear war, and I really don't want to read another one. And she said, but you never read a book like this on nuclear war. And she was right. I hadn't. This is a new concept. This one opens Pandora's box like we've never seen Pandora's box opened before. Let me take you through just one section that deals with this concept. See if I can find the page number here. I think it's page 171, if I remember right. And listen to a couple of three lines over here, just for openers. And let's see if you'd thought of this. This starts off, it says, thank God our elevation is high enough, our climate cool enough, or we'd be worrying about mosquito-borne diseases like malaria or West Nile and others. And don't even get me started on how we better start looking out for parasitic worms and lice. His voice trailed off. We will see infections running rampant that won't kill, but they will weaken, leaving the victim open for the next round. Kate, most guys don't even think about it, but do you have a good supply of what we euphemistically call feminine hygiene products? She blushed slightly. For this month. Well, that's the problem right there, though I bet a lot of other women are thinking about it now or finding out real quick. They're back to great-grandma's days, and that combined with no bathing, poor diet, we'll see a soaring infection rate, and that's just one of a dozen situations that we never thought about before last week. Johnny steps on a rusty nail and needs a tetanus shot. We might have 100 of those shots left in the whole community. We might be staring at lockjaw come fall. Do you want me to go on? No one in the room spoke. John looked into his old friend's eyes and could see that his doctor, more than perhaps anyone else in the room, was haunted by just how medieval this nightmare might get. Well, let me pause right there and let's think about what we just read. This story takes place in South Carolina, in a small town, a college town, of about 10,000 people. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or 3, long in there, the power goes off. Everybody's in the house, and the power goes off. That's pretty normal. Hell, you've been in the house and the power went off. And so they were upset at the inconvenience of the power being off. And so the guy goes over to the telephone, picks it up, and wants to call to find out, well, what happened and when will the power be back on? But there's no telephone. The telephone's out. And he thought to himself, well, that's strange. The telephone company isn't dependent upon the electric power grid. They have their own electrical supply. It runs on low voltage. So he goes out on the deck, and he's sitting out there for a few minutes, and he is struck by the fact that while his house is close to the freeway, there's no sounds coming from the freeway. There's no traffic. And so he sends his daughter, he says, run over to the fence on the freeway, which is, you know, maybe a quarter of a mile over, and take a look and tell me what you see. And so the little girl goes over to the freeway. She comes back and she says, Daddy, all the cars are stopped. And people are out walking around. Now, this guy, Forsham, you know, who writes the book here, is also a military man. And as his character, John, in the book, wakes up to the fact, he says, the power is off, the telephone is off, and now my daughter reports that all the cars on the highway are stopped? And immediately, the hero of the book, John, who is a colonel from the Army or the Air Force, says, oh my God, could it be an EMP? Now, perhaps those of you out there who have military training, maybe you've heard of EMPs. Maybe you've been through training. I've talked to some people now since I've read the book, and there's quite a few people out there that are alerted to this thing of EMP, but I was totally, totally ignorant. I didn't have a clue. Never even entered my mind. But it has now, and that's why I thought I would make this report, the report on EMP, because now that I've read the book, I could almost make a downright prediction. If I was the Russians or the Chinese, I would not launch a preemptive nuclear attack on the United States until after I had launched the EMP attack and knocked out all of your communications first. Because then the effect of the nuclear attack would be 100 times more effective, as you'll see as we continue on with the story of 1 second after. But let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number to call is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click on to the archives page and download it yourself. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about EMP and Bill Forshin's book. It's William R. Forshin, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N. Book is called 1 Second After. It's a novel. I normally don't read novels, and I don't recommend them. And that's because I don't have time to spend on make-believe and Alice in Wonderland. Occasionally, though, a novel comes up, such as Alas, Babylon, which has to be a fiction story because it hasn't happened yet. It's almost like Bible prophecy. Bible prophecy is reality written in advance by a God who's able to perform. He can actually bring this to pass. Now, Mr. Forshin doesn't have the power to set off one of these EMPs. And Pat Frank doesn't have the capacity or the ability to set off a nuclear weapon over Orlando, Florida, as is depicted in his book, Alas, Babylon. Now, the creator of the universe can do that, has done it in the past, and says he's going to do that in the future. So you can just about take that to the bank. So when we take a look at Bible prophecy, or we view these two books in the light of Bible prophecy, all of a sudden we see some very stark realities. First of all, in Ezekiel chapter 5, that chapter deals with the destruction of the United States of America. And in chapter 6, verse 6, it deals with the specifics of a nuclear attack. Now, it doesn't tell us that the nuclear attack is going to be by EMP or 20 megaton bombs. We didn't know that. Not until the nuclear era. Once the nuclear era came upon us, then all of a sudden when we looked at Ezekiel 5 and 6, we said, oh my God, now I can see what God was telling us some 2,500 years ago. That's the way that just jumps out and grabs you. Now, in the book Alas, Babylon, there's actually no EMPs. This is a book, let me give you a little background on it. You can probably pick this up in a used bookstore. If not, let me tell you how you find these books. You go into any used bookstore and you tell them that you're looking for the book Alas, Babylon, A-L-A-S-B-A-B-Y-L-O-N, written by Pat Frank. That's all you need. They'll type that into their computer, and their bookstore will be hooked up with 500,000 bookstores worldwide. That's a bunch. And they'll find that book, Alas, Babylon, a copy of it, in some used bookstore. It may be in Long Beach, California, or it may be in London, England. And one time I got a book out of Cape Town, South Africa. But they'll find it for you. And then they'll tell you what the price is. And sometimes they're rare books, and sometimes they'll have the grade of it. You know, is it in good condition or poor condition? And sometimes they're even autographed by the author. You have to pay a little extra for that. But they'll get you a copy of the book. This other one over here by William Forshin, I think we just got this one at Barnes & Noble not too long ago. Now, Alas, Babylon takes place down around Orlando, Florida. Let me give you a little background here, and then I'm going to tell you something that is so real about this whole problem that we're facing, and that is subsistence and survival. And this guy, the hero of the book in The Last Babylon, has a brother who is in the Strategic Air Command. And one day his brother from Omaha, Nebraska, calls him down here in his little town, 40 miles from Orlando, Florida, and tells him that in 2 days the Russians are going to launch a secret sneak attack, and that they know about it in advance, and he's got 48 hours to prepare for it. So the hero of our Last Babylon book goes out, and he buys a whole bunch of food. I mean, he goes down to the grocery store, and he buys up stuff, and he sticks it in the freezer, and he sticks it in the shelves, and one thing or another. He goes down, fills up his gas tank with gasoline, and he's just doing all the things that need to be done in the 48 hours leading up to the attack. Now, he contacts his sister-in-law from Omaha. She's driving from Omaha. The brother, you know, sends his wife and kids down to a safe place out in the countryside in Florida. And so he's making preparations for his sister-in-law and his niece and nephew, and you know, just doing everything he can, because, you know, in 48 hours this thing is going to strike. And he's just doing all the right things. You know, he's getting ready for an atomic attack, a bombing attack. And so when the attack takes place, he's looking out the window, and here's this bright flash over Orlando, Florida. And immediately the lights go out. The lights go out. Well, of course, when the bomb goes off, it knocks down the power grid somewhere, and all the lights go out in the countryside. The power lines, you know, that come from the generation plant, you know, the power plant, those heavy-duty, humongous transmission lines. Well, hell, all you got to do is knock one of those towers over, and then that's the end of the power, isn't it? Not just for Orlando, but for all the countryside around it. And so, you know, the bomb goes off, and then there's some more dialogue in the story, but here's the bottom line. Remember all this frozen food that he bought, put in the freezer? Well, all of a sudden now, they've got all this food in the freezer, but there's no power. So they start eating the food. These people do not know how to can it. They're not Amish people. See, if this was the Amish would go take it and can it, put it in jars, can it, and keep it. Canned food, you know, keeps for years. Frozen food keeps for a few days when the power goes off. So these people are eating up their food and they're having a good time at it. But finally it ends, and that's all they've got. Now, there's a corollary story. There's a great panic on after the bomb hits. And the people in the little town where this guy lives, they all go down to the gas station and fill up their cars with gas. And the guy in the gas station really feels good about that, because this is the biggest, busiest day he's ever had. He sells all of his tires, all of his radiator hoses, all of his fan belts, sells all of his gasoline. It is a banner day. He sold $6,000 worth of gasoline and goods and tires and everything. He sold out. $6,000. So at 6 o'clock that night, as he's checking out, he looks and he sees he's got $6,000. He puts that in his bag, and he's just happy as a clam at high tide. He goes out and gets in his car. And he starts it up, and he notices that his car's got a quarter of a tank of gas. And he says to himself, I guess I better fill up my gas tank. And then to his chagrin, he remembers that he has pumped all of his gasoline out. He sold it all. He doesn't even have any gasoline to put in his own car tank. But he does have $6,000. All in paper money. Which is instantly valueless. Instantly valueless. Because where is he going to deposit it? He's got checks, credit cards. negotiable instruments, and Federal Reserve notes, which is only good in a banking system. And now all of a sudden, there isn't any banking system. There isn't any electricity. And the people, in their panic, have gone into the stores and they've bought up all the food. They've cleaned out the hardware stores. They've bought up everything they could. And the people who are running these stores, they're selling the stuff and they're taking their valuable nuts and bolts off the shelves and converting it into paper, which is inherently valueless. So the people are wise enough to get rid of their paper and convert it to goods. But the only goods that are available are the goods on the shelves. And we find out that transportation has now been shut off. When you bomb a major city in your local area, you're going to find out that all of a sudden there's no transportation into or out of the area. You can't get trucks in and out. The rail lines are severed. And all of a sudden now, you can't get supplies, you can't get replacements. And it's worse than 1959 today because now we've introduced a new process in the management of our supplies, and that is just-in-time delivery. So let's think about this for a second. Just-in-time delivery. When I was a kid, back in the 1940s, it was a big thing when a truck came into the C&V market and unloaded. They had a warehouse behind the store. And the truck would come in and the boxes were coming off of the truck and they'd come down these rollers. And all the kids in the neighborhood would stand alongside and push these boxes along the rollers. And the men would be unloading the truck and loading it onto carts and taking it back and storing it in the warehouse. What that meant was, in our neighborhood, for the four square blocks that were serviced by the C&V market, they had about a 90-day supply of ketchup and mayonnaise and other foodstuffs, you know, that we would be wanting to buy. They actually had it in the warehouse. When they took a jar of mayonnaise off the shelf in the store, they had another case or two or five back in the warehouse with which they could replace that jar of mayonnaise. So in 1945, if there was an emergency, the people that lived there in that neighborhood would have had about a 30-day, 60-day, or 90-day supply of food right there at the C&V market. They didn't need another truck delivery. They'd already got their truck delivery in. And they kept that warehouse full. I can remember going into that warehouse, and sometimes it was plumb full, and sometimes it was half full, but I don't ever remember seeing it less than half. It always had half. But sometimes that thing would be full and overflowing, and then they had a couple of outbuildings that they had to put stuff in, and then sometimes they'd have to put stuff in the aisles in the store because they didn't have room in the warehouse. And it was a pretty good-sized warehouse, and I would say four square blocks. When I was a kid, we didn't have supermarkets, so we had little grocery stores like the C&V Market and Tripoli Market and Canham's and Connick's Corner Grocery. And each one of those grocery stores would service about four blocks. Now there's about four houses on one side of the block and four on the other, so you got eight houses per block. Now you got four square blocks. 4/8 is 32. So each store would service about 32 houses. 32 families would have their own grocery store. Not much of a store. Some stores a little bigger than others, you know. But, you know, when we bought food in those days, we bought a sack of beans, a sack of flour, a sack of sugar. So you had 100 pounds of sugar, 100 pounds of beans, 100 pounds of cornmeal. 100 pounds of Pillsbury's Best flour. Those came in 100-pound sacks. We didn't have refrigeration, so we had an ice plant downtown. That's where you bought a half a beef or a quarter of a beef. And then if you were rich, you had a whole beef. If you had a big locker, we always bought a half a beef or a sheep or something like that. So we had meat. And then once a week or twice a week, you'd go downtown and it was 12 blocks from our house to the ice house. Pick up your frozen meat and bring it home, and you know, you'd have a couple, 3 days worth of meat, and do that twice a week. But everybody had a pantry, and everybody had food in their pantry, and we had about a one-year supply. My granddad used to tell me we had a one-year supply of food starting about October or November, at the end of the year when the harvest was in, and we lived in the city of Eureka, we had about a one-year supply. And it wasn't just us. Mrs. Swain, next door, she had a year's supply. Mrs. Johnson and Mrs. Birchfield, Ronnie Mitchell and his family, they all had a year's supply. Now let's take a look at just-in-time delivery. Today, when I go into the auto parts store and I want to buy an auto part, I can be absolutely certain that when I go into O'Reilly's, they will not have that part in stock. Well, you know, if you went in to buy a set of spark plugs, yeah, they'll have that. They'll have spark plug wires. They'll have a can of WD-40. But when you go in there to buy a 1984 Ford carburetor, they won't have it. Now, they used to. They used to carry carburetors in the store, but I don't anymore. And for good reason. You see, O'Reilly's has about 50 or 100 and 200. I don't know how many they got, but they got a lot of these little retail stores. And they got a central warehouse over in Springfield. So they can sit back with their computers and they can say, how many 1984 Ford carburetors did we sell last month? And the answer is maybe 5. Out of 200 stores, they sold 5 carburetors. So they don't need to carry 200 carburetors in each of their 200 stores. They just need to carry about 5 or 10 of those carburetors in their central warehouse. And they do that with all their auto parts. Now, as soon as I go into my local O'Reilly's and I say, I need this 1984 carburetor, they will punch it into the computer and they'll say, yes, we've got it, and it'll be here tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. And they will order it right then. And sure enough, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, when I go into that store, my carburetor will be there. And if they don't have it in their central warehouse, they'll tell me. They'll say, hey, we don't have that. We don't have it in our central warehouse. We're going to have to order that from the manufacturer, and that's going to take a week. But they'll order it right then. And by God, a week from now, it'll be here. And it'll come out of Detroit or someplace else. It's called just-in-time delivery. It's a great innovation in the management of inventory. Walmart does that. As soon as you check out of the Walmart store, their computers will tell exactly what it was that you bought, and they will reorder, and tomorrow morning's truck will have it on it. And they'll keep that replaced. Now that's good for Walmart, and it's good for O'Reilly's, but it's not good for you and me. Because in an emergency, And the truck doesn't come in at 8 o'clock in the morning, it doesn't come in for a week or a month, that means that we're not going to be able to get any of those goods for a week or a month, not until the truck comes. And that's where EMP comes in, and that's where Alas Babylon comes in, and that's the Achilles heel of America and indeed most of the industrialized world. We have now become so dependent upon our computers and our just-in-time delivery that if that were knocked out for any period of time, that is going to really impact upon our standard of living. It's worse than that. In the event of an EMP attack, think about this for a second. You pull into your local gas station and you want to fill up with gas, and so you push the button, and the pump comes on automatically from the inside of the store. You pump your gas, you go inside, and you pay. Take a look the next time you fill up your tank, and notice that there's a display. That's an electronic gas pump. It doesn't run on 110 volts. It's true that the pump is running on 220 volts, but the controls, the servo controls, are running on millivolts. Just little tiny wires in there. Those are computers, computer chips, circuit boards that run on a half a volt or a quarter of a volt. And here's what the EMP does. When there's a surge of electricity coming through the air, the electrical circuit boards pick up 50 volts of electricity, which is on a circuit board designed for 1 or 2 volts or a half a volt or a quarter of a volt, and it just burns it out. Burns it up. I had that happen. I've got a controller board here on my solar panels, and one day I pushed the wrong lever over here, the wrong switch, and a surge of electricity went through my controller panel over there and just smoked it. I mean, instantly. It was just smoke coming out of it and totally burned up, wasted. And so I saw how that works. Now, we did that by putting 120 volts down the wrong pipe. We went to work on that and we fixed that little glitch, but moral to the story is, here's a $6,000 controller panel over here, smoked because, hey, you got too much power running through it. In 1859, a solar flare occurred over North America, a solar flare from the sun. And it was quite an event because it knocked out the telegraph service. The telegraph service. You know, where there's telegraphs, there's wires. And this electromagnetic pulse from the sun was picked up on those wires because they acted as an antenna and it burned them out. Now, in 1859, there wasn't very much in the way of telegraph wires in the country. And it burned up a bunch of them, and it wrecked a lot of equipment. If that were to occur today, it would knock the entire electric power grid out in the United States. And you Canadians would be right along with us. And you Mexicans, right along with us. It'd knock it all out. It'd fry it. It would burn it up. Now watch what happens. You're in your gas station and you're pumping your gas with this electronic marvel. The controls are all electronic. And that's what's going to be burned out. And once it's burned out, even if the electric power came on the next day, you'd have to replace all of the electric circuit boards and all of those gas pumps and the control panel that's inside the gas station. And like as not, that's going to happen to all the gas stations. And like as not, those parts are going to be coming from some other place in the world. Singapore, Hong Kong, the Philippines, Indonesia, Germany. That's because we have a world economy. And in this world economy, all of these parts, all of these electronic marvels are made in other countries, made in other factories and plants around the world. And the best estimates are that it would take at least 90 days to get the power grid back up and running after an EMP attack, if in fact the parts were available, which they're most likely not going to be. Well, we're running out of time. That's the story that we have on EMP up to this moment in time. We'll be back tomorrow and tell you a little bit more about 1 second after. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org.